This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane and famous Exxon gasoline. The wake-up call is also brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. Now with your host, Rick Moore.
Good morning and welcome to the Wake Up Call. This is Pete Ronayne sitting in for the resting and vacationing Rick Moore. I know that he's somewhere enjoying March Madness. And we get to turn our attention to a great topic today, one that I'm sure that Rick was here for himself. And we're going to talk some Shakespeare. So if you want to feel very smart and get your Sunday morning off to a great start, you've tuned to the right place. Let me do a little bit of announcing for you and let you know that support for WNRN today is also coming from Blue Ridge Mountain Sports, where spring means it's time to come in and get outfitted for trail running or hiking. Whether you're experienced or just starting out, the staff at Blue Ridge can get you to all the right places. At brms.com, you can find out about backpacking clinics, guided hikes, paddling, and community events. You'll find Blue Ridge Mountain Sports in the Barracks Road Shopping Center, Charlottesville, at Wintergreen, and in Richmond. Well, it is my pleasure to introduce our guests today from the American Shakespeare Center in Stanton. We have Dr. Ralph Cohen. Good morning, Ralph.
Hey, Pete, how are you?
Good. How are you doing? Your bracket's okay? Well, maybe we'll get to that. And we've got Sarah Enlow as well. Sarah, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm not hearing these guys, but they both said good morning in a very friendly way right then, just so you know. All right, let's try that again. Ralph?
Hey, how are you, Pete?
Hey, there you go. Great, much better. All right, super. Ralph, give us a little background. We'll do some quick bios about who you guys are, and we'll get to some more detail. But you are the director of mission and a professor of English at Mary Baldwin. What is director of mission at American Shakespeare Center?
Well, we founded the company 20 years ago at James Madison University, and we have a very special approach to doing Shakespeare, which we think is extremely accessible. And out of that has come a lot of sort of goals, and those goals are our mission, and I'm sort of in charge of making sure that we stay on mission, and we are so far.
And you are a director as well.
Yes, I'm a director and one of the co-founders.
Great, excellent. And Sarah Enlow, we'll try again. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Pete.
How are you?
Fine. How are you doing?
Great. And tell us about your role briefly at American Shakespeare Center.
I am the director of education at American Shakespeare Center, so I work with groups from as young as 9 to 12-year-olds in our midsummer day camp and all the way up to elder hostel groups who come in and take classes from us in the theater, including the Federal Executive Institute and other groups that want to talk about Shakespeare in leadership, Shakespeare in the classroom, and Shakespeare for fun. So that's what I do.
Great. Now, for those who don't know, American Shakespeare Center in Stanton, Virginia, and you guys have been there for how long?
Well, we moved to Stanton we opened the Blackfriars Playhouse in 2001. We moved our operations there 2 years before while we were building the Blackfriars Playhouse. And for you listeners who don't know, the Blackfriars Playhouse is the world's only recreation of Shakespeare's indoor playhouse. He's more famous, and you had to learn about the Globe Playhouse. That was his outdoor playhouse,
right,
but actually had an indoor playhouse as well. And we moved there and opened it in 2001. The company started in 1988 at James Madison University.
Great. And I want to get to more of sort of the history of both Blackfriars and American Shakespeare Center in a second. But jumping back a little bit, and we'll start with you, Ralph. How did you come to Shakespeare yourself, or maybe more accurately, how did he come to you? How did you get into this?
I went to college, and I was a pre-med, and chemistry was like really required a lot of homework, so I became an English major.
And I remember running from that.
Yeah,
myself.
I was like, wow, this is hard. So I became an English major and decided to I had some wonderful English professors, and I was working on I went to graduate school at Duke, and I was working on Faulkner, and every time we started looking at Faulkner, my professor kept talking about how indebted he was to Shakespeare. So I decided, well, let's work.
Go to the source?
Let's go to the source. Let's go to the source, and that's how I got into it.
Great. Excellent. And Sarah, how about you?
Well, I guess you could say that I started my theater career as a four-year-old child when I was cast to sing a song about Germs, my invisible dog, and one of the lines was, and he often falls asleep when the sermon goes too long. So I discovered the power of theater for redirecting.
A lot of people are having that thought perhaps as we're speaking, actually.
After that, of course, I studied him in high school. I went to college at the University of Texas at Austin, and I became a high school teacher and directed a lot of Shakespeare and then won an NEH Institute Award to study for a summer in Massachusetts, which is where I met Ralph. He came to give a lecture, and I discovered that Shakespeare is about a lot more than just words. He's about stagecraft, too, and we can count on his stagecraft to give us insight into the beauty of his work. So I decided to come and get my master's in Shakespeare in Stanton and began working for the company after I graduated.
Great. Excellent. Now, back to the issue of Blackfriars, and I'll start with you, Ralph. You guys having the only recreation of Shakespeare's indoor theater. And there's a great story behind that. Everybody knows about the Globe, right? That's what we know about. But can you give a little bit of that history about the name, the origins of that inside theater? And then we'll get to what would somebody who hasn't been there, what would they see? I've seen it, and it's beautiful, but we'll paint a mental picture. But what is the story of Blackfriars?
Well,
way back when.
Okay. In Shakespeare's London, the advent of theater is dated around, you know, then theater. There was theater in England from the Middle Ages. I mean, plenty of theater in different ways, but there were not theaters. Theaters, a place where you could charge admission, stand at the door, keep people from coming in unless they had a ticket. The commodification of theater didn't take place until theaters were built. And the first ones that were built are like the Globe that you study in high school. They're great three-story structures, open air, and the play took place in the center of it, and you get about 3,000 people in there, and those started appearing around in the late 70s, 1570s, and the company that Shakespeare worked for was ambitious to have a space that was year-round, I guess would be an easy way to put it. They were looking for a space that was year-round, but they also wanted not to have to deal with their landlord anymore, and they got hold of this old dining hall, really, that had belonged to the Dominican monks that were called the Black Friars.
Right.
The monks and all of the rest of the Catholic Church had been thrown out by Henry VIII, so this building was available. And what they did was they went in and they refurbished it to be a theater. And they decided that by that time they could charge 10 times more than they had charged to stand outdoors. And the bet paid off.
Because it was a classier proposition? Because you're inside?
It's a classier proposition. And also that space had been used for many, many years by the nobility. In fact, the divorce of Henry VIII took place in that space. It was a very famous space. And I think that a lot of what happened and a lot of the interest in it was that people who went there were already sort of marking their position as like, cool, we were at the Blackfriars. So they figured they could play on that and make it a high-class place to go to. And they kept their outdoor theater as well. But when they were able finally to move into their new theater, their indoor theater, it really was the Blackfriars that for whom the public was most excited. I mean, that's what the public was most excited about, was the Blackfriars. And when
so this wasn't like, this is not a naming rights issue. It's not like a Qualcomm Stadium, you know, Blackfriars.
No, it wasn't actually. It was just that was the most, that's what everybody called that area because the Dominicans who wore black robes had been there.
Yeah.
And that's what they called it. But it, so it became, Blackfriars Playhouse became the name. And it was destroyed. The Puritans closed all theaters in 1642 and then, in the next decade, that building was torn down. So there hasn't been one for 400 years.
And why is that? I mean, it's interesting to think, and I want to get to sort of the why Stanton question, but first, why no recreation anyplace else? I mean, we talk about Shakespeare constantly, right? Invoke him, biographies, it's a constant thing. Why over these 400 years or so has nobody else done this?
Damn, good question. Early in the morning.
That's what we're paid for.
Yes, yeah. Well, no, seriously, that's a very good question. For one thing, everybody thought that the technology, the sets, the moving scenery, all those sorts of things that began to come in after the Restoration in the late 17th century, those things took over everybody's imagination. And because the Blackfriars had only been a hall, a big hall that had tiered seating in it and a very nice stage, but no movable sets, no curtains, anything like that, it seemed kind of dated to them.
Yeah.
And so the most romantic thing, when people started thinking about recreating Shakespeare's theaters, the most romantic space in their minds was the big open-air globe. And people have been saying or trying to recreate the globe for about a century now, and they have finally succeeded in a really nice one in London that Sam Wanamaker and friends opened in 1997. Mm-hmm. But I'm here to tell you that the other theater had a lot of really special things about it, too. And here's the main thing for our company that's so important, and for the listener who's never seen Shakespeare in the space. The space was lit by chandeliers and by candlelight. And the light was on both the actors and the audience. Mm-hmm. And so that's that thing, it's shared with the globe. Now, these new theaters that were being built after the Restoration were moving more and more to a darkened audience, more and more separating the audience from the performance.
Which is sort of our standard
which
today.
Which is how we tend to think of theater. And what really happened with the Blackfriars that was so great was that gallants would sit on the stage, and the stage was surrounded by its audience, including the richest people would be sort of behind the action, looking down, being seen.
Like performing in the round.
Exactly. And a place to be seen. And because it was a place to be seen, it was a very exciting space with regard to making you feel a part of things. And that's the real secret of what we think of enjoyable Shakespeare is sort of this inclusion.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 91.9 WNRN. We're joined by Dr. Ralph Cohen and Sarah Enloe from American Shakespeare Center in Stanton, talking about the Blackfriars Theater, past and present. So capacity at Blackfriars originally and today, what's our speculation?
Well, we're pretty certain about these numbers because we had the dimensions. And there was about they could get about 500 people in there, and we have the same size space, and we actually are code.
You have fire codes, right?
We have fire codes. The fire code actually says 500, but customers would not pay to sit that close to one another. So even though fire code allows us to do what they do, we really have a maximum seated capacity of 300 and standing room for another 70.
Great. Now, for both of you, maybe Sarah, if you want to get this started, because you certainly are well versed in the company as well. Why Stanton? All right, so when I think of American Shakespeare Center, you know, no offense, but let's put it on the table. Stanton isn't what would first come to mind. So there's obviously an interesting backstory about why this very highly praised, well-reviewed. I mean, you guys have gotten coverage in the New York Times and the Washington Post, I mean, nationally, internationally, Wall Street Journal. How does it end up to be beautifully located for us, to be sure, right here in Central Virginia? Why Stanton?
Well, Stanton is beautiful, as you mentioned, and it also has a group of city fathers, we'll call them, who really supported what they saw happening at JMU and made contact with Ralph and Jim in 1995.
And so what was happening at James Madison?
We started our company as a touring company, where it would go into any space, leave the lights on, play in the thrust, include the audience, mm-hmm. Actually, the guy owned a bed and breakfast there, mm-hmm. Thought, wouldn't it be great if we had some Shakespeare here? And that's sort of how it started. And as Sarah says, the city fathers were supportive of that.
And the city has really gotten behind it. You can come to Stanton and walk around all weekend, never have to get into your car, mm-hmm. go on a trolley to the park, go hiking if you'd like. Lots of great restaurants, cute shops, all of those things. And we're following a model that is not absolutely without precedent. Ashland, Oregon's had a Shakespeare festival for 90 years, mm-hmm. and they are as small as we are,
sure.
and they draw many, many people because they are a destination theater. And that's really what we think the American Shakespeare Center can be and is. A lot of people, almost, well, over 50% of our audience drives more than 90 miles to attend a play. So we really are a little center in the heart of Virginia.
Yeah, well, it shows great vision. There's no doubt about it.
There's another little thing for Virginians. I don't want to be a nativist, but there is a reason for Shakespeare to be in Virginia.
Oh, yeah.
Let's go native. Come on, Ralph.
The people who founded Jamestown were supporters of the theater. They were the same people who would have gone to the Blackfriars in London, which was operating when Jamestown was founded. And they supported theater. They liked theater. They put on plays themselves. And so, in a way, Virginia is historically the place Shakespeare first came, whereas that other state, Massachusetts, I think it's called.
Careful now.
Yes,
got to
be really
don't make
careful.
Me come across the table.
Well, they were founded by the Puritans, the people who
they would have shut
the
down Blackfriars.
They would have shut that Blackfriars right on down.
Great. So that's another a good version of think global, act local. Literally.
Exactly.
Literally, act
exactly.
local. You're listening to The Wake Up Call on 91.9 WNRN. If you have a question for our guests, Ralph Cohen and Sarah Enloe from American Shakespeare Center about Shakespeare, drama, the theater, you name it, 979-0919, give us a ring, or 1-877-967-6762. So a patron comes out to attend a show, has never been there. What's your signature? What is... And what is defining about attending a show at American Shakespeare
yeah,
Center?
Yeah, I want to say the first thing that the patron's going to notice when they open the door and they walk from our modern lobby into our very carefully reconstructed 16th century space is that it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. It's really beautiful. And this is actually a problem for us when we started because people would come in and get reverent. And that's not what we want. We don't feel that was the atmosphere that was in the original space. We have worked very hard to make sure that does not happen anymore. And what we do is actually historically correct. We do a lot of music. Our music is contemporary. The actors come up with it themselves. They do a very comic pre-show. They try to put the audience at ease with that. We sell beer and wine off of the stage. The lights stay on, and there is a real sense of party that you will not expect. And I think the other thing that will surprise you, especially if you have any anxiety about Shakespeare, is that when the words start coming at you, they don't sound old, they don't sound different.
Yeah.
And we'll talk more about that, I know. But so I think that I've said this frequently, and I just said it yesterday to a huge group. What I would love to have happen is for people to say, you know, it's a beautiful day. I'd love to go on over to the Blackfriars. I'll have a day in Stanton and not even care for sure what the show was because they know when they walk in that space between the show and the music and the food and watching one another, they're going to have a great time.
They're going to have a good time. And I can only imagine, just jumping back to what Sarah was talking about in terms of why Stanton, that the American Shakespeare Center, that you guys have been an anchor, a developmental anchor for the city. I don't know to what extent that's been quantified, but you know, much like a new stadium in downtown Washington D.C., you know, leads to this ripple effect of development and a critical mass. You guys gauged that? Or
well, we have a little presentation we give about all the businesses that have opened since us, and probably because of us. It again, as Sarah said, the city fathers had already been very careful to preserve what was downtown, but we really were the tipping point. There's a wonderful new hotel next door called the Stonewall Jackson. It was renovated, and there's a great little conference center. And there are, I mean, if you can count. If coffee shops are a measure of the vitality of town, then the tipping point definitely was when we opened up and all sorts of coffee shops opened. We had some wonderful new restaurants. And I heard that one of your sponsors in the previous segment was the Visualite.
Visualite, yes.
The Visualite. Well, Adam Greenbaum came in to town and started, I think, one of the great arts film venues, a great place to go. So all that sort of stuff is coming. And when you're in Stanton, sometimes you think it really is sort of ground zero for happening stuff. And it's everything from Shakespeare to the most modern film.
Now, you hinted at it before, Ralph, and I did want to get into this. You speak eloquently, I think, and passionately about what you call Shakespeare, which is a great play on words. What is Shakespeare? I'm sure a lot of our listeners have it. They might have even considered turning the station because they thought, oh, God, not Shakespeare, not this intellectual pointy-head stuff. I'm not up for that on Sunday morning. Let me go check my March Madness bracket. What is Shakespeare exactly?
Well, I just tell you that everybody in our society has it a little bit because we are required in all of our high schools, in every state in the union, it's the only thing I know of that's required in every state in the union, to read Shakespeare. And so it becomes associated with things like the SATs and intelligence tests and all that sort of stuff.
And let me ask you on that, yeah. And Sarah, you as well, because you have a background. Mm-hmm. Is Shakespeare, is it introduced too early in schools? And the reason I ask that is I can remember being in school, and it actually wasn't Shakespeare in this case. Like, I remember reading Moby Dick, and I forget what grade it was, but it just, I hated it. Because I don't think I was ready. Maybe it wasn't taught the right way, but it was premature. It's like, here's this classic. You really should know it, and so we're going to make sure you get it, but it was a little bit too early. Now, hold on. I'm going to ask you for your answer in just a second. We've got a little bit of business to attend to.
Okay. You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by The Hook and by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, a refreshing pause on your journey to anywhere with locations all over town. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
Today's programming on WNRN is also brought to you by Copacabana, Brazilian international cuisine, serving lunch and dinner every day. Every Saturday, Copacabana serves Brazilian entrees like, wow, I'm going to try to pronounce this one, feijoada. That sounds great. Copacabana also serves Brazilian cocktails. That's Copacabana, Brazilian international cuisine in Shoppers World, 29 North Charlottesville. And the Markets of Tiger Fuel forecast for Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley. Mostly sunny today with a high of 60 to 63. Partly cloudy tonight with lows dipping down to 35 to 40. And then mostly sunny tomorrow with a high of 52 to 57. Right now in the valley, it's 48, 50 in Lynchburg, 47 in Richmond, and in Charlottesville, 49. With our guests, Ralph Cohen and Sarah Enlow from American Shakespeare Center. My name is Pete Ronayne, sitting in for the resting and vacationing Rick Moore. So I had to cut you guys off, but the question I had on the table, and we're going to get back to Shakespeare, and I guess we're talking about sort of its origin or genesis. Do we introduce Shakespeare too early or too ineptly? Sarah, what do you?
I would have to say that it's not a too early, it's a too testy thing. we introduce Shakespeare as a poet instead of as a playwright. And I think that if you went back to early modern England and asked the guys who were skipping school and skipping work to go see Shakespeare's plays, they would think that they were not too young to hear about it.
So too much of the sonnet stuff early?
It's turning the plays into beauty. To be read rather than seen and experienced in a theater. And I think that you hit on a very good point about Moby Dick. You know, was it put on you too early? Was it bad teaching? And I don't want to imply that we have bad teaching happening with Shakespeare, but I do think that sometimes we're looking at it as a poem instead of as a play.
Yeah.
And the essential word play really implies something very different than what we sometimes do in school. And I think that Shakespeare is completely fun and accessible when students realize that he was writing humans into these stories, mm-hmm. and that his language is the language that we all use today, 98.5% of it, common usage words in the 21st century English language. And we can get it, we can understand it, if we're not forcing it into a pigeonhole of a poem, mm-hmm. which I think is sometimes the way that we go. So that's what we work on at the American Shakespeare Center. Seeing the plays and performance is one of the quickest, easiest ways to convince students, hey, this guy wrote well. And secondly, teaching them through performance. So looking at ways to get your students up and in the play rather than reading it at their desk.
And I think in terms of the curriculum, I have an analogy, and I just want to grab it while I can. if we thought of architecture and famous buildings, you know, obviously Shakespeare is the canon, famous plays. And if we thought of famous buildings and we say Monticello, and we gave kids, as an appreciation of Monticello, what they had to do was look at drawings of it, mm-hmm. and see the sketches in class and study them and then have a test on them.
Study the dimensions and the math of it.
Instead of walking through the place and seeing it, then they probably have the same resistance to Monticello that a lot of people have to Shakespeare, which is that it's just that's not what the experience ought to be when you first encounter it. And a lot of the work that we do in our workshops with teachers is to help teachers who haven't been shown themselves how to go at it from that point of view, how to go to the plays from the point of view of staging, how to get their own students on their feet, even if they're not theater teachers, mm-hmm. and get them to enjoy the plays in that way.
So it's sort of trying to almost redemocratize small d Shakespeare.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
Now, and I think related to that, I mean, Sarah, you mentioned what 98% of the words are in usage today.
Mm-hmm.
So we do expect when we show up that I'm not going to understand this
right.
this old English or whatever. It wasn't old. Well, I don't even know. You know what it was.
Well, but a lot of people do say that. They say old English, and it's really not. It's actually modern English. It's the very beginning.
It's the transition,
of
correct?
English, yeah.
Well, it's more than that because in fact, he was so good that he helped to sort of shape it. And so the English that they were speaking when they landed in Jamestown is really primarily what we speak today.
Few more of these and thous? Is that?
A few more, that's it. And things that you could easily.
And these and thous are fascinating.
It's much more difficult to understand, say, for example, a modern Irish film, Dublin. You know, 2009. Make a movie there.
It does take time to get your ear. I reviewed the Commitments, which I hadn't seen. In
right,
a while. Great film, by the way.
Right, it's a wonderful.
I mean, it takes
film.
You a while to understand what they're saying.
But you do it, and you aren't sitting there thinking you're going to get tested on it, which is the huge thing. You know it's there to be had. And so what we find is that when good actors take those words, and the other thing that I mentioned earlier is that our audiences are in the light with the actors. And because they're in the light with the actors say the words to the audience.
So you're engaged right off the bat.
And there are no long speeches because every speech is broken up by the actor looking at a different person and doing a sort of assumed dialogue, even in a long speech. So Hamlet's 30 line to be or not to be is really a bunch of little questions put this way and that, and the text disappears as a text. It doesn't seem to be text anymore.
It's a person speaking.
It's a person speaking to you.
Right.
And expecting that you're listening in a way that makes you listen. And a good actor can make all that just so clear.
And these actors are experts in the language, and the these and thous become something to the audience member that they aren't when you read them on the page. And that's because these actors realized that in early modern England, the use of thee and thou was like talking to your very best friend. When I say thee, that means I really, really love you and I'm glad to be here with you. When I say you, I'm being more formal. It's like I'm talking to my principal or to my boss. But when you see that on stage, instead of reading it, you actually get that.
Because you can feel it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you can use thee as an insult if you're talking to someone who is higher than you.
You shouldn't be saying
thee. You shouldn't be saying
it. It's just like in free.
That could be a great t-shirt. Feel the thee.
Feel it.
Feel the thee.
Very nice.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. I'm Pete Ronayne sitting in for Rick Moore. And we are joined by Sarah Enlow and Ralph Cohen from the American Shakespeare Center. If you have a call, a comment, a question, maybe even a short soliloquy, we might have time for that. 979-0919 or 1-877-967-6762. Back to Shakespeare, which is a great term. I think it's a question of the audience too, Ralph. I've heard you speak of this. Who was Shakespeare's audience? I think a lot of people think they envision a Shakespearean audience to be professors, elites. Plays intended for then, and it's your intention today as well, I understand it.
It's very easy if you look at the numbers to think who Shakespeare's audience wasn't. The town of London and the city of London in Shakespeare's day was about 200,000. The theater, and it was one of several, held 3,000, right? So right away, we're not talking about something that was for the elite, just in terms of numbers.
It can't be. The demographics wouldn't hold.
It would be like going, the demographics of a good, at Camden Yards, a baseball game at Camden Yards would be much closer to what it was. And here's the other thing. The people who went to see those plays did not go to those plays with that already owning that language. They went because they wanted to hear some good language, and that's a huge difference. So there is a misconception that somehow you've taken Elizabethan off the street and bring him into a theater, he'd understand it better than you would. That's not actually true. The difference is he'd be hungry to hear it. That's the big difference.
And we have a call with, I believe, a question. Caller, are you there?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Hi. First, a comment. I just want to say that I love the American Shakespeare Theater, and you all do make Shakespeare so accessible.
Thank you.
I remember one of the first plays I went to see, I thought I had to pull out my Shakespeare and read the play before I went to see it.
So you had Shakespeare as well?
Yes. And didn't get a chance to review the play before I went, but it was completely accessible. The action and the actors just really made it so easy to follow.
That's great. I hope some of our actors are up early enough to be listening.
I hope so. My question was whether or not you all always have such great music, and I was wondering if you ever have recorded the pieces that you all write or the actors write specifically, you know, for the play?
That's a great question. We talk about doing it all the time because, of course, we do some covers, but they actually write a lot of what they do. And we do have a contract so that we can use some of that music. And we haven't ever gotten around to it. You know, we stay so busy just doing what we're doing. However, all of the shows are archived, and we have an archive, and they're all archived. So we do have a record of what's being done. But it would be a great thing, I think, and something we, when we have the time, we need to follow up on, of just getting them, sitting them down and just doing the music. Because they, as you point out, our actors are terrific musicians, very creative, and we hire them in part because we know there was good music at the Blackfriars, and we can't afford to hire a separate consort to do the stuff. So they have to be able to do both things.
And I would like to add in that we did recently on YouTube post a video that does have one of those original pieces on it as background for the shots that we're showing. So I'll get that up on the front page of our website, a link to it, so you can go there and at least hear one of those songs from Midsummer Night's Dream that the actors wrote and worked up together.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Well, thank you all so much for everything you do. And I don't know if A Midsummer Night's Dream, has that run?
I'm so glad you mentioned it.
Promo opportunity.
Yeah, no, but no, actually, it's a warning. This is as good a Midsummer Night's Dream as you'll see, and I think Pete's just recently seen it, and he'll agree.
I did, yes.
It's a fabulous show, and there is only one more evening show of it available because we're in our Actors Renaissance season where we're doing a bunch of other plays, and that evening is the Thursday, this coming Thursday at 7:30, and you should get there a little early to get some of this music we do in a pre-show. So that's the last opportunity to see what I think is really one of the best Midsummer Night's Dreams I've ever seen. Now, I've only seen about 75 productions, so I don't know how.
So not that you have a base to judge.
But this is really good, and I just want to say to the audience, the fact that I'm director of mission and executive director, that doesn't have much to do with being proud of this particular piece, because the directors do not direct during the Actors Renaissance season. So I'm only praising the work of our wonderful actors here. Do go see that show, caller, because it is a beauty.
Laura, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right.
Well, Laura broke the ice, so if you want to join in, well, a call, a question, a comment, 979-0919, 1-877-967-6762 to talk with Ralph Cohen and Sarah Enloe from American Shakespeare Theater here on Wake Up Call. All right, so we've done a little bit of talk about Blackfriars, the history, contemporary Blackfriars. Anything else on the Shakespeare thing, Ralph? Again, if there's a listener out there who's started to inch towards, yeah, maybe I'll hop online and check out the shows, but still a little bit anxious about it. What else do you guys do that makes it signature and overcomes Shakespeare?
Well, again, I think it's, for me, this is a really big issue of what is theater and what is, you know, what has it become? What was it? What has it become? And what can it be? The statistics on theater audiences are pretty depressing if you love theater. For the most part, it looks as though older people go to theater and younger people don't. And
so is it parallel to opera? Is it?
I think it's like opera, but I think in some ways opera is a little safer because opera lovers will have the music in their house and their kids will get, you know, there's a little bit more intensity there. Theater lovers, I think that there's an equivalent in, say, seeing a good film or going to see a big Broadway musical. And really that experience is different from what you get at the Blackfriars. And I guess the best, I'm trying to think of a good analogy, but if you've ever been to a great comedy club where your response to what's going on, the fact that the comedian can see you and can respond to you, that's more of the kind of atmosphere that we're trying to bring back to theater at the Blackfriars, is to put the audience back in. But and so to make the experience just a social one as well as a theatrical one. The show is, we think we do the shows as well as they can be done. We love having these great actors who come to us, by the way, from all over America. We spend a lot of time finding the best people possible. But really also, we love the music and we love watching one another. And you will find audience members leaving and as though, feeling as though they know one another because they're seeing each other during the show. It's a wonderful experience. and it is quite different from anything you expect, and I think helps a great deal lower your whole anxiety about the evening. After a while, you really simply aren't aware that you're listening to a language that has a few differences between yours and then.
So, you know, and on that issue, and Sarah, I'll start with you.
Mm-hmm.
How is it that this playwright, his work, Shakespeare, larger-than-life figure, certainly, how is it that he speaks to us today in 2009? 400 years ago, we're talking about. How is it that this endures?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, Shakespeare was writing humans into his plays, and those humans still carry a lot of the same emotions and issues that we deal with on a regular basis. In A Midsummer Night's Dream, which we just talked about with Laurel, we are seeing two sets of high school students fall in love for the very first time, or go through what it's like to have a crush and not have it reciprocated, and the bringing to life of that experience, the words that Shakespeare used to create that are so true. When you go and see Sarah Fallon portraying Helena and Miriam Donald portraying Hermia, you believe those girls are best friends. You believe that Helena wants nothing more than to be romantic with the boy that she's in love with. And it's so fun because we've all been there. Shakespeare writes characters that we can relate to, that we can understand and empathize with. And you see it throughout his work. We have Henry on Henry VI on stage right now. And the person playing the king as a young teenage angsty boy actually hits the nail right on the head, and you completely get, oh wow, that was a teenage king, and this is what he's going through.
And have we put to rest the speculations, et cetera, that it wasn't one guy, that it was or somebody else? That, you know, because we know so little about Shakespeare himself, right? The documentary evidence is interesting little fragments, but is that over and done with? Because that crops up from time to time, or it was Marlowe or somebody
that
else.
That will never get over and done with.
Because it's a conspiracy theory? Is it?
It will never get over
Did
and
I just
done
annoy
with
you?
It's
fun
right?
to talk about, but it is absolute. First of all, we have an enormous amount. We have 212 references to Shakespeare in his lifetime. And this is going to get some callers, I imagine. There's really no doubt among scholars who wrote the plays. It was a man named William Shakespeare. And actually, they've just recently discovered a portrait they think is Shakespeare. And it should help a little bit because he looks more upper class than some of the other ones. And a lot of people out there just want Shakespeare to have been upper class. That's never going to go away because people. I think it's not going to go away in part because people want revenge for what happened to them in high school, and they think a great way to have revenge is to say, "Well, you didn't even write."
He didn't even exist. He's going to tear it down.
Things,
you know? Yeah,
but it's not going to make the plays go away. So yeah, it'll be there. The New York Times will be looking for a story in about a year, and they'll rerun it again, and then we'll all be talking about it again.
And Ralph, let me ask you a related question off of that. So Shakespeare's one guy, but. How, in your mind, how has our understanding of Shakespeare or our interpretation of him, how has it changed as we change? And what I mean by that, I was struck by recently the commemoration of President Lincoln's 200th mm-hmm. birthday, and how Lincoln has meant different things in different eras, depending on who we are as a people, depending on what society is going through, and depending on sort of what lens we maybe even need at the time. And so we reinterpret him as a different sort of hero, as a different kind of leader, as the compromiser, as a crusader. To what extent does Shakespeare morph similarly over time? And maybe who is he today?
That is such a good question. And if I may, I'm just going to start and then pass it off to Ralph. But Shakespeare was a businessman. He wrote plays for his company that he had a share in, and he wanted to make money with those plays. So he was writing to sell plays, to sell tickets, to sell words.
Which is such an angle, sorry to jump in, that nobody thinks about.
He was an incredibly successful business venture.
So he's an entrepreneur.
And he made a lot of money.
Then we began to develop a love of romantic poetry, and this is where I pass it off to Ralph because he has a great way of dealing with it.
Well, I just want to say this about, I think there are two reasons that we still today find him such a lens. One is he really is a great writer. He is as one of my friends likes to say, he is the most underrated a writer that ever lived. And in spite of all the great things that are said about him, he is that good. And he uses the language and deploys it beautifully. But the other point, you said it yourself, Pete, you said the word reinterpret. What he knew, because he was an actor, is that whatever he wrote was going to be handed to someone to reinterpret. And there's a way in which his plays are already there for us to reinterpret, because he understood that that language is embodied by whoever's using it. If that's true for an actor, it's true for an age as well.
We're going to come right back to that question of reinterpreting Shakespeare. We're talking with Ralph Cohen and Sarah Enloe from American Shakespeare Center.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by the Markins of Tiger Fuel and by The Hook, an innovative weekly on newsstands every Thursday. Now here's Rick with what you can find in this week's Hook.
This week in The Hook, who will lead the UVA men's basketball team following Dave Lado's departure, a new day shelter on Market Street for the Steveville community, and revisiting Anna Anderson, the royal imposter. That's this week in The Hook. And additional support today is also coming from 45fix.com. If you have a home improvement project, there's another way to find a contractor. It's 45fix.com. From remodeling to repair projects, immediate no-obligation estimates are available anytime. That's 45fix.com, the number 4, the number 5, and the word fix.com. Well, today at noon, join Drew Thompson for Les Temps Perdus, the best of 80s and 90s alternative. There will be no Elton John or Christopher Cross, but you will hear Foo Fighters, The Offspring, and Radiohead. Requests are always welcome. That's Les Temps Perdus, brought to you in part by Plan 9 Music and Basil. And tomorrow, Monday the 23rd, is the kickoff day for the WNRN Spring Fund Drive. Once every 6 months, we come to you for your financial support to keep programs like Sunday Morning Wake Up Call and Acoustic Sunrise on the air in Central Virginia and the Valley. Without the support of listeners like you, the programming you enjoy on WNRN wouldn't exist in this area. Also, it's not too late to get involved in the drive as either a phone volunteer or, if you're a business, as a donor of premium items. For info, give us a call on the NRN studio line, 979-0919. You can also dial up that number, 979-0919, or 1-877-967-6762. If you have a question about Shakespeare, anything related to Shakespeare, the contemporary drama, etc., for Professor Ralph Cohen and Sarah Enloe from the American Shakespeare Center right over in Stanton. So, back to reinterpreting Shakespeare, how he has evolved, how we have perhaps evolved in how we see him, how we depict him and understand him, and where that stands today.
Well, I think you get it all over the place now. I mean, they're movies, of course. You see them in ads. I remember an ad I really loved one time. It was a cool guy. It was for a car. It was in Denmark. And the guy's sitting in the car, and he's a really cool guy. He's got a leather jacket on, and he's reading Hamlet. You know, you just see it in popular culture everywhere.
And let me jump in there for both of you, and then we'll come back. Best on-screen Shakespeare that you've most enjoyed, whether it's just straight ahead or it's more sort of modern reinterpretation.
I just heard there's a Measure for Measure out there that I need to see. My own personal favorite in English that was done by an English director with an English cast using the English script is Chimes at Midnight that Orson Welles did about all of the Henry IV material. I think it's a wonderful movie and it has some amazing performances in it. I came to Shakespeare. You asked earlier when I first liked Shakespeare. I didn't much care about Shakespeare until I saw Olivier's Henry V, and I was sitting there being scornful of it, and I suddenly realized that the person who wrote it was a lot smarter than I was, and I loved that. I still think that's a great one. But in terms of when it can become very interesting is when foreigners take it on and make a film of it, because they don't have to be, they're not tied to a script. And I do think that that Kurosawa did some wonderful films, both of Macbeth and of King Lear, that are worth people's time.
Sarah, your favorite on-screen adaptation?
I really like Scotland, PA for Macbeth, and I actually like the Ethan Hawke Hamlet as well. There's something to that that's quite refreshing. But I'd say Mel Gibson's Hamlet in its fast-paced way is a really great on-screen Shakespeare experience.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point, because Mel Gibson, well, everybody laughed when Mel Gibson was...
Right, because it seemed like sort of a lightweight...
Yeah.
But it reminds us that the first guy who did it was a kind of a pop star too, and that it was about a hero, and so I thought it really worked great, and I love the way he took, the very unpompous approach he took to it. I thought it was really good.
Yeah. Great. There's good things to add to our Netflix queues. Mm-hmm. So I interrupted Ralph. You were talking more about and reinterpreting Shakespeare, how he's evolved over time and sort of where he is today.
I was saying that a playwright, on say, for example, Milton, you know, I don't think we don't talk about the world through Milton anymore because it was a poem and it lays there as a poem. But when you're a playwright, you're writing for people who are going to pick up your script and reinterpret it. Reinterpretation is already built into the words. I mean, because that's where you start, that somebody's going to take this and do something different with it. And I think it's left it for the ages to continue to do that so that you get, you know, I can't even tell you how many of Shakespeare's plays have been reinterpreted in the last 4 or 5 years in the light of, the war in Iraq. I mean, mm-hmm. Everyone gets hold of it and sees things again through it in that way. It is really remarkable. But I think the secrets involve, one, the language, the use of the language is just so fresh and inventive. But also, there's something incomplete about it. It needs reinterpretation. It's written to be a script.
Great. Sarah, did you want to jump in on that?
Well, and as if we're talking about going through time, then I think that we really start with it being for the popular culture, moving into public education. When public education began to incorporate Shakespeare into the curriculum, we started to see it as required, and Shakespeare took on an elite place instead of being the businessman that we know that he was. And it became, a mark of being intellectually elite, mm-hmm. to identify Shakespeare as one of your loves and courses of study instead of being a mark of being cool or popular or knowing what's cool. And so I think that what we like to do at the American Shakespeare Center, and what you can see in our audiences when you come and see that we have college kids, high school kids coming back again and again, is that Shakespeare is cool, and we want to get that back into the mindset of our audience members.
We do keep numbers. We keep, you know, we do stats, and one of the things we found is that we have the strongest demographic of any Shakespeare company in the age group 19 to 45.
Excellent. I want to get back to some more questions about audience, but speaking of audience, we have a call. Scott, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Scott from Charlottesville. Go ahead.
You were talking about sort of the reinterpretation through the words, and obviously you all deal with sort of the interpretation through just the physical layout, props, the scenery, and so forth. How important do you think that is to keeping it alive?
Well, that's a great question, because one of the things I think Pete was referring to is in these reinterpretations, a lot of it has to do with how do you put it on the stage, and we've gone through various periods in the late 19th century. You know, they would build a pyramid. They had a pyramid on. I think, did we lose our?
Thank you, Scott. He hung up to listen. Go ahead.
Oh, okay, great. But they would actually build pyramid, and they'd have a forum and all that, and they'd have it on the stage, and they bring it out. So give you the world, recreate that world, and then in the 20th century, because of technology, we've been able to do things with revolves and great scenery and back projection and things like that have been able to sort of free the plays from their original space. But the thing about that original space was it was a bare stage, which did allow the imagination to come in a lot. And what we do at the Blackfriars is we'll set it in any period. I mean, we don't care about that. But we won't build a set for it because we have this beautiful theater, stays the same, bare stage. But the costumes might be from this period or they might not be from this period. We use them all for all periods. And people come out and make you believe that you're seeing modern America or old England. So that's the game for us, is the imagination. And so I would say that you've got those two poles that have been working really for 400 years of simple imaginative productions that are based on your imagining it, and then more elaborate illusion productions that are based on kind of create the illusion of a certain period.
And we kind of follow Shakespeare's instructions in Romeo and Juliet on that matter, because when you add sets, lights, blackouts, changing, all of those things, you have a hard time sticking to that whole 2 hours traffic of the stage, which is something that we really do shoot for. We want the Shakespeare that is on the Blackfriars stage to be quick and to be clear and to communicate these human characters in a way that you get and it's an just moves quickly so that you don't sit there waiting for the next set to change.
Yeah, what Sarah just said is really important, and I'm glad she brought it up. We're committed in our theater to getting an audience who comes for a show at 7:30 out of there about 10 o'clock. And you can say, well, that's sort of arbitrary. Well, it's really not. The average Shakespeare play is 2,600 lines, and it would take, normally speaking, 2 hours and 10 minutes to read those 2,600 lines. Throw in an interval or two. Have a beer, you're out by 10. And I think that's important. I think that's one of the things we're trying to do is make it less pretentious, make art less pretentious.
So it's less weighty and more accessible.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we are not particularly interested in basking in some sort of Shakespeare or even theater glow. We want audiences to have a good time, and we care very much about the amount of time they have to sit watching.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 91.9 WNRN, and we are chatting with Ralph Cohen and Sarah Enloe from American Shakespeare Center. Screen actors that you admire and are on your short list, you like them because of their approach, because it resonates with what you try to create in a theater, not a movie theater context, but theater context. What are some screen actors that stand out for you
guys?
Well,
I'm very prejudiced in this regard because we're friends with Judi Dench, and not only that, I have watched her show my students the difference between acting on the stage, acting on TV, and acting for a movie.
And what is the difference?
Just,
so it's a bunch of lay people listening here. What's the difference?
It's really a question of size. On the stage, you have to make an audience that could be as far as, 100 feet from you, see your face, understand what your body is doing, and so you're just got to be a little bigger. On the movie screen, on the TV set, it's going to be about your face, and any little thing you do is going to show up because it has been until widescreen. It's pretty much a medium for two heads, for head speaking. In film, it's somewhere in between. And so she'll do a line and she'll show you what she would do in the film, what she would do on TV, and what she would do on the stage. And it's the same thing. It's just like you turn the volume up a little bit. It's just notched up. And I think she's great. I think her performance in Mrs. Brown was one of the great performances ever, and I do wish you'd gotten the Academy Award for it. But I have many. I love the actor like the Cary Grant, who doesn't seem to be acting. Or today, Clint Eastwood, and I'm trying to think of other people. I think Clooney does it.
So that fluidity,
that ease, the ease of who you are, and the putting who you are into the bottle that particular movie makes for you. You put that person in, you don't try to do a lot. Then you have the other kind of actor like Meryl Streep, who seems really to be able to change herself entirely. I tend to like the former kind better, but I love Meryl Streep's work.
Sarah?
I'm a big fan of Parker Posey, actually, and that is simply because she seems to not only put herself into the character and just go with it from there, but she also always seems to be laughing a little bit at herself, and I just love that. And it's something that I feel like it makes you as an audience member go along with her for the ride, and so I really enjoy her work.
What's the hardest play that you've worked with, the hardest ones to put on?
That's a good one.
Well, the hardest one for me from a point of view of blocking a play, there are a lot of different challenges for a director.
And blocking a play means?
And blocking a play means where your actors are going to be on stage. And when you work at the Blackfriars, you can't hide. There are no curtains. We don't have sets. It's an open, bare space that's thrust out into the audience. So the difficult play, from my point of view, is Love's Labor's Lost, because you've got four sets of lovers. Four sets of lovers, plus you got, in addition to that, the clowns. So anytime the lovers are on the stage, you've got eight people on the stage, and somebody's going to be talking, and what do you do? Like one couple's talking, what do you do with the other three couples? Mm-hmm. Where do they go? What are they doing? And that's always an issue.
So the logistics of it.
It's a logistics problem. I think the hardest play to direct in many ways is actually Macbeth. Because I think Macbeth is, everybody thinks is really easy, but what's going on, the energies in that play are very, very difficult to harness.
So why would people think it's easy, Ralph?
Because it's for one thing, it's short. They read it in school. It's a really clear story when you read it.
So the narrative is just
it's
sort of A to Z?
But I think for actors to accomplish some of those parts are really hard. An interesting Macbeth, a really good, I'm talking about the male, king now, the male lead. That guy, is a complicated creature. And in order to have any kind of sympathy for him or anything else, you have to choose some odd things. I mean, you have to get in it in a hard way. It's hard to find an actor who can do that. And so I think that's one of the toughest roles to play is Macbeth. So there are different kinds of challenges for a director. But Sarah's directed a lot, too. So, Sarah?
Well, Sarah, your experience?
I directed Love's Labors, and I agree with Ralph on that point. And for the same reasons that he gave, Much Ado can be quite complicated because we've also got four sets of lovers, although two are clearly more prominent than the other. But there's also that whole Kenneth Branagh throw in the window scene that was never written to be seen, that when I gave it to my students, they had an expectation. Oh, we should. Why aren't we doing the window scene? Well, it's not.
And explain that, Sarah, for somebody who hasn't seen the.
Well, there in the play, Hero, the young juvenile female lead, is accused of making out with a man at her window, and it's actually been her maid who has agreed to implicate her in some way. So in Branagh's version, which is a wonderful movie, and it really...
That's with Emma Thompson and Kenneth Branagh
and
Denzel Washington.
It really opened up Shakespeare to a lot of people. He shows it, and I just found that to be... Well, it wasn't in the script, and it seemed like it mm-hmm. made it too concrete. Instead of theater of the imagination, suddenly we have theater of invention, which... is his choice, but I just didn't agree with it. I would say the other one that would probably be the most difficult, surely because of body count at the end, and because of the expectation that audience members have coming into the theater, is Hamlet, which is we have coming into the Playhouse in April, and it is a wonderful production of Hamlet that our actors are doing, and I think that the body count is handled pretty well. But that whole expectation of, okay, he's about to do to be or not to be. How is he going to do it? What are we going to do with that speech that's different? Or are we going to do something different? That one, I think, can be challenging as a mental obstacle for a director and mm-hmm. for a Hamlet.
So I think it's interesting we get back to the question of expectations. And so when you have an iconic play like Hamlet, mm-hmm. It is really difficult, I think, for the cast and for the audience to get past that and just see the play that's there.
Yeah.
This is WNRN Charlottesville and WNRS-FM Sweetbriar Amherst Lynchburg. Today's programming on WNRN is being brought to you with the support of Blue Ridge Graphics, Mead Avenue at East High Street, serving Charlottesville with custom T-shirts, sportswear, and professional graphic design since 1979. That's Blue Ridge Graphics, 296-9746. That number on page 739 of the Charlottesville Yellow Pages, and at brgtshirts.com. Well, tell us about the upcoming season. You're wrapping up Midsummer Night's Dream, which I will confess I'll do a back promo. I saw, and it was absolutely great. It was one of the funniest things, and it reminded me, to Ralph's point about Shakespeare, about how bawdy and dirty and raunchy fun Shakespeare is. I mean, not all of them. There's body count stuff, too, but it was great. So what do we have to look forward to? Here's your pitch.
Yeah, all right. I'm going to pitch real quick for what we've got now to the end of next week, which is our amazing Actors Renaissance season, where we do plays you don't normally get to see. The Revenge's Tragedy at 7:30 on Friday. The Changeling, another astonishing and shocking play written in the period by Middleton, and that's at 2 o'clock on Saturday. An early Shakespeare history play, 7:30 that in the evening, 1 Henry VI. And then a play that hasn't been done since 1602, a really funny comedy called The Blind Beggar of Alexandria, is on Sunday. And coming in, as Sarah has said, coming in starting the following week is Hamlet. I don't think I need to say much about that play.
But do say something about it, because
right,
people know Hamlet. That's, you know, we talked about some screen versions before. I mean, there's a lot of familiarity.
Well,
so what's why do I want to come see your Hamlet? I've seen it. So why do I want to come?
Because every single time you do it, Hamlet allows more for interpretation, more for sense of you can do a funny Hamlet, you can do a melancholic one, you can do one that's all about the violence, you can do one that's all about the love. It really does open itself, and it's kind of the big 800-pound gorilla of all of drama. It sucks people in like a black hole when you start talking about it among scholars. And if you ever go to the Folger and you take a look at the number of books that they have for each of the plays, it dwarfs everything else. Hamlet it's just great. We have a wonderful guy playing Hamlet, and to go with it and to sort of throw it into context is the play Tom Stoppard wrote, sort of making fun of some of the issues in there and looking at it from minor characters' points of view. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead, and that'll be be playing. And then finally, Comedy of Errors, which is one of Shakespeare's light works and is a terrific piece of work. Also, great evening out.
And I'd also like to add that I don't think we've mentioned that our plays are done in rep, so you get to see the same actors in all of these plays, which means that Horatio is Horatio in both Hamlet and Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, and then he plays a merchant in Comedy of Errors, and he's wonderful. And Hamlet plays, and by the way, very cute, Hamlet plays Hamlet, but then he also plays...
So Ralph's playing Hamlet, right?
Yeah. Antipholus in Comedy of Errors, and our Dromios in Comedy of Errors are fantastic, and one of them plays, was it Rosencrantz or Guildenstern? I always get them mixed up. So it's a wonderful opportunity to see a range in a weekend of these actors who are amazing.
Great. Well, listeners, get yourselves over to the American Shakespeare Center in Stanton. I want to thank our guests today, Ralph Cohen, Director of Mission and Professor of English at Mary Baldwin, and Sarah Enlow, Head of Research and Academic Resources at the American Shakespeare Center. Pleasure chatting with you. This has been the Wake Up Call. Rick will be back next week. I'm Pete Ronayne. Thanks for joining us. Liz Temps is up next, so stay tuned.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. And by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane, Exxon gasoline, and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@AOL.com or at wakeupcall@WNRN.org. The wake-up call is produced by Sean McCord. Tune in again next Sunday morning at 11 for the Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.